Chapter 4. The Drawing. 1. As the sun's bottom arc first touched the western sea in Roland's world, striking bright golden fire across the water to where Eddie lay trussed like a turkey, Officers O'Meara and Delavan were coming groggily back to consciousness in the world from which Eddie had been taken. "Let me out of these cuffs, would you?" Fat Johnny asked in a humble voice.
"Where is he?"
O'Meara asked thickly, and groped for his holster. Gone. Holster, belt, bullets, gun. Gun! Oh, shit. He began thinking of the questions that might be asked by the shits in the Department of Internal Affairs, guys who had learned all they knew about the streets from Jack Webb on Dragnet. And the monetary value of his lost gun suddenly became about as important to him as the population of Ireland, or the principal mineral deposits of Peru. He looked at Carl and saw Carl had also been stripped of his weapon. Oh, dear Jesus, bring on the clowns, O'Meara thought miserably. And when Fat Johnny asked again if O'Meara would use the key on the counter to unlock the handcuffs, O'Meara said, "I oughta..." He paused because he'd been about to say, "I oughta shoot you in the guts instead," but he couldn't very well shoot Fat Johnny, could he? The guns here were chained down, and the geek in the gold-rimmed glasses, the geek who had seemed so much like a solid citizen, had taken his and Carl's as easily as O'Meara himself might take a pop gun from a kid. Instead of finishing, he got the key and unlocked the cuffs. He spotted the .357 Magnum, which Roland had kicked into the corner, and picked it up. It wouldn't fit in his holster, so he stuffed it in his belt.
"Hey, that's mine!"
Fat Johnny bleated.
"Yeah? You want it back?"
O'Meara had to speak slowly. His head really ached. At that moment, all he wanted to do was find Mr. Goldrim Specs and nail him to a handy wall with dull nails.
"I hear they like fat guys like you up in Attica, Johnny. They got a saying, the bigger the cushion, the better the pushing. You sure you want it back?"
Fat Johnny turned away without a word, but not before O'Meara had seen the tears welling in his eyes and the wet patch on his pants. He felt no pity.
"Where is he?"
Carl Delavan asked in a furry, buzzing voice.
"He left," Fat Johnny said dully. "That's all I know. He left. I thought he was going to kill me."
Delavan was getting slowly to his feet. He felt tacky wetness on the side of his face and looked at his fingers. Blood. Fuck. He groped for his gun and kept groping, groping and hoping, long after his fingers had assured him his gun and holster were gone. O'Meara merely had a headache. Delavan felt as if someone had used the inside of his head as a nuclear weapons testing site.
"Guy took my gun," he said to O'Meara.
His voice was so slurry the words were almost impossible to make out.
"Join the club. He's still here?"
Delavan took a step toward O'Meara, tilted to the left as if he were on the deck of a ship in a heavy sea, and then managed to right himself.
"No." "How long?"
Delavan looked at Fat Johnny, who didn't answer. Perhaps because Fat Johnny, whose back was turned, thought Delavan was still talking to his partner. Delavan, not a man noted for even temper and restrained behavior under the best of circumstances, roared at the man, even though it made his head feel like it was going to crack into 1,000 pieces.
"I asked you a question, you fat shit! How long has that motherfucker been gone?"
5 minutes, maybe," Fat Johnny said dully. "Took his shells and your guns."
He paused.
"Paid for the shells, I couldn't believe it."
5 minutes, Delavan thought. The guy had come in a cab. Sitting in their cruiser and drinking coffee, they had seen him get out of it. It was getting close to rush hour. Cabs were hard to get at this time of day. Maybe.
"Come on," he said to George O'Meara. "We still got a chance to collar him. We'll want a gun from this slut here."
O'Meara displayed the Magnum. At first, Delavan saw two of them. Then the image slowly came together.
"Good."
Delavan was coming around. Not all at once, but getting there, like a prize fighter who has taken a damned hard one on the chin.
"You keep it. I'll use a shotgun under the dash."
He started for the door, and this time he did more than reel. He staggered and had to claw the wall to keep his feet.
"You gonna be all right?" O'Meara asked. "If we catch him," Delavan said.
They left. Fat Johnny was not as glad about their departure as he had been about that of the spook in the blue suit, but almost. Almost. 2. Delavan and O'Meara didn't even have to discuss which direction the perp might have taken when he left the gun shop. All they had to do was listen to the radio dispatcher.
Code 19, she said over and over again. Robbery in progress, shots fired. Code 19, code 19. Location is 395 West 49th. Katz's Drugs. Perpetrator tall, sandy-haired, blue suit.
Shots fired, Delavan thought, his head aching worse than ever. I wonder if they were fired with George's gun or mine, or both. If that shitbag killed someone, we're fucked, unless we get him.
Blast off, he said curtly to O'Meara, who didn't need to be told twice. He understood the situation as well as Delavan did. He flipped on the lights and the siren and screamed out into traffic. It was knotting up already, rush hour starting, and so O'Meara ran the cruiser with two wheels in the gutter and two on the sidewalk, scattering pedestrians like quail. He clipped the rear fender of a produce truck sliding onto 49th. Ahead he could see twinkling glass on the sidewalk. They could both hear the strident bray of the alarm. Pedestrians were sheltering in doorways and behind piles of garbage, but residents of the overhead apartments were staring out eagerly, as if this was a particularly good TV show or a movie you didn't have to pay to see. The block was devoid of automobile traffic. Cabs and commuters alike had scattered.
I just hope he's still there, Delavan said, and used a key to unlock the short steel bars across the stock and barrel of the pump shotgun under the dashboard. He pulled it out of its clips. I just hope that rotten crotch son of a bitch is still there.
What neither understood was that when you were dealing with the gunslinger, it was usually better to leave bad enough alone. 3. When Roland stepped out of Katz's Drugs, the big bottle of Keflex had joined the cartons of ammo in Jack Mort's coat pockets. He had Carl Delavan's Service 38 in his right hand. It felt so damned good to hold a gun in a whole right hand. He heard the siren and saw the car roaring down the street. Them, he thought. He began to raise the gun and then remembered they were gunslingers. Gunslingers doing their duty. He turned and went back into the alchemist shop.
Hold it, motherfucker! Delavan screamed.
Roland's eyes flew to the convex mirror in time to see one of the gunslingers, the one whose ear had bled, leaning out of the window with a scatter rifle. As his partner pulled their carriage to a screaming halt that made its rubber wheels smoke on the pavement, he jacked a shell into its chamber. Roland hit the floor. 4. Katz didn't need any mirror to see what was about to happen. First the crazy man, now the crazy cops. Oy vey.
Drop!
He screamed to his assistant and to Ralph, the security guard, and then fell to his knees behind the counter without waiting to see if they were doing the same or not. Then, a split second before Delavan triggered the shotgun, his assistant dropped on top of him like an eager tackle sacking the quarterback in a football game, driving Katz's head against the floor and breaking his jaw in two places. Through the sudden pain, which went roaring through his head, he heard the shotgun's blast, heard the remaining glass in the window shatter, along with bottles of aftershave, cologne, perfume, mouthwash, cough syrup, God knew what else. 1,000 conflicting smells rose, creating one hell stench. And before he passed out, Katz again called upon God to rot his father for chaining this curse of a drugstore to his ankle in the first place. 5. Roland saw bottles and boxes fly back in a hurricane of shot. A glass case containing timepieces disintegrated. Most of the watches inside also disintegrated. The pieces flew backwards in a sparkling cloud. They can't know if there are still innocent people in here or not, he thought. They can't know, and yet they used a scatter rifle just the same. It was unforgivable. He felt anger and suppressed it. They were gunslingers. Better to believe their brains had been addled by the head-knocking they'd taken than to believe they'd done such a thing knowingly, without a care for whom they might hurt or kill. They would expect him to either run or shoot. Instead, he crept forward, keeping low. He lacerated both hands and knees on shards of broken glass. The pain brought Jack Mort back to consciousness. He was glad Mort was back. He would need him. As for Mort's hands and knees, he didn't care. He could stand the pain easily, and the wounds were being inflicted on the body of a monster who deserved no better. He reached the area just under what remained of the plate glass window. He was to the right of the door. He crouched there, body coiled. He holstered the gun, which had been in his right hand. He would not need it. 6.
What are you doing, Carl?
O'Meara screamed. In his head, he suddenly saw a Daily News headline. Cop kills four in West Side drugstore snafu. Delavan ignored him and pumped a fresh shell into the shotgun. Let's go get this shit. 7. It happened exactly as the gunslinger had hoped it would. Furious at being effortlessly fooled and disarmed by a man who probably looked to them no more dangerous than any of the other lambs on the streets of this seemingly endless city, still groggy from the head knocking, they rushed in, with the idiot who had fired the scatter rifle in the lead. They ran slightly bent over, like soldiers charging an enemy position, but that was the only concession they made to the idea that their adversary might still be inside. In their minds, he was already out the back and fleeing down an alley. So they came crunching over the sidewalk glass, and when the gunslinger with the scatter rifle pulled open the glassless door and charged in, the gunslinger rose, his hands laced together in a single fist, and brought it down on the nape of Officer Carl Delavan's neck. While testifying before the investigating committee, Delavan would claim he remembered nothing at all after kneeling down in Clements and seeing the perp's wallet under the counter. The committee members thought such amnesia was, under the circumstances, pretty damned convenient, and Delavan was lucky to get off with a 60-day suspension without pay. Roland, however, would have believed, and, under different circumstances, if the fool hadn't discharged a scatter rifle into a store which might have been full of innocent people, for instance, even sympathized. When you got your skull busted twice in half an hour, a few scrambled brains were to be expected. As Delavan went down, suddenly as boneless as a sack of oats, Roland took the scatter rifle from his relaxing hands.
"Hold it!"
O'Meara screamed, his voice a mixture of anger and dismay. He was starting to raise Fat Johnny's magnum, but it was as Roland had suspected. The gunslingers of this world were pitifully slow. He could have shot O'Meara 3 times, but there was no need. He simply swung the scatter gun in a strong, climbing arc. There was a flat smack as the stock connected with O'Meara's left cheek, the sound of a baseball bat connecting with a real steamer of a pitch. All at once, O'Meara's entire face, from the cheek on down, moved 2 inches to the right. It would take 3 operations and 4 steel pegs to put him together again. He stood there for a moment, unbelieving, and then his eyes rolled up the whites. His knees unhinged, and he collapsed. Roland stood in the doorway, oblivious to the approaching sirens. He broke the scatter rifle, then worked the pump action, ejecting all the fat red cartridges onto Delavan's body. That done, he dropped the gun itself onto Delavan. "You're a dangerous fool who should be sent west," he told the unconscious man. "You have forgotten the face of your father." He stepped over the body and walked to the gunslinger's carriage, which was still idling. He climbed in the door on the far side and slid behind the driving wheel. 8. "Can you drive this carriage?" he asked the screaming, gibbering thing that was Jack Mort. He got no coherent answer. Mort just went on screaming. The gunslinger recognized this as hysteria, but one which was not entirely genuine. Jack Mort was having hysterics on purpose, as a way of avoiding any conversation with this weird kidnapper. "Listen," the gunslinger told him. "I only have time to say this and everything else once. My time has grown very short. If you don't answer my question, I'm going to put your right thumb into your right eye. I'll jam it in as far as it will go, and then I'll pull your eyeball right out of your head and wipe it on the seat of this carriage like a booger. I can get along with one eye just fine, and after all, it isn't as if it were mine." He could no more have lied to Mort than Mort could have lied to him. The nature of their relationship was cold and reluctant on both their parts, yet it was much more intimate than the most passionate act of sexual intercourse would have been. This was, after all, not a joining of bodies, but the ultimate meeting of minds. He meant exactly what he said. And Mort knew it. The hysterics stopped abruptly. "I can drive it," Mort said. It was the first sensible communication Roland had gotten from Mort since he had arrived inside the man's head. "Then do it."
"Where do you want me to go?"
"Do you know a place called The Village?"
"Yes."
"Go there."
"Where in the village?"
"For now, just drive." We'll be able to go faster if I use the siren.
Fine, turn it on. Those flashing lights, too.
For the first time since he had seized control of him, Roland pulled back a little and allowed Mort to take over. When Mort's head turned to inspect the dashboard of Delavan's and O'Meara's blue and white, Roland watched it turn but did not initiate the action. But if he had been a physical being instead of only his own disembodied Ka, he would have been standing on the balls of his feet, ready to leap forward and take control again at the slightest sign of mutiny. There was none, though. This man had killed and maimed God knew how many innocent people, but he had no intention of losing one of his own precious eyes. He flicked switches, pulled a lever, and suddenly they were in motion. The siren whined, and the gunslinger saw red pulses of light kicking off the front of the carriage. "Drive fast," the gunslinger commanded grimly. 9. In spite of lights and siren and Jack Mort beating steadily on the horn, it took them 20 minutes to reach Greenwich Village in rush-hour traffic. In the gunslinger's world, Eddie Dean's hopes were crumbling like dikes in a downpour. Soon they would collapse altogether. The sea had eaten half the sun.
"Well," Jack Mort said, "we're here."
He was telling the truth. There was no way he could lie. Although to Roland, everything here looked just as it had everywhere else. A choke of buildings, people, and carriages. The carriages choked not only the streets, but the air itself, with their endless clamor and their noxious fumes. It came, he supposed, from whatever fuel it was they burned. It was a wonder these people could live at all, or the women give birth to children that were not monsters, like the slow mutants under the mountains.
"Now where do we go?"
Mort was asking. This would be the hard part. The gunslinger got ready as he could, at any rate. "Turn off the siren and the lights. Stop by the sidewalk." Mort pulled the cruiser up beside a fire hydrant. "There are underground railways in this city," the gunslinger said. "I want you to take me to a station where these trains stop to let passengers on and off."
"Which one?"
Mort asked. The thought was tinged with the mental color of panic. Mort could hide nothing from Roland, and Roland nothing from Mort. Not, at least, for very long. "Some years ago, I don't know how many, you pushed a young woman in front of a train in one of those underground stations. That's the one I want you to take me to." There ensued a short, violent struggle. The gunslinger won, but it was a surprisingly hard go. In his way, Jack Mort was as divided as Odetta. He was not as schizophrenic as she was. He knew well enough what he did from time to time. But he kept his secret self, the part of him that was the pusher, as carefully locked away as an embezzler might lock away his secret skim. "Take me there, you bastard," the gunslinger repeated. He slowly raised the thumb toward Mort's right eye again. It was less than half an inch away and still moving when he gave in. Mort's right hand moved the lever by the wheel again, and they rolled toward the Christopher Street station where that fabled A-train had cut off the legs of a woman named Odetta Holmes some 3 years before. Ten.
"Well, looky there," Foot Patrolman Andrew Staunton said to his partner, Norris Weaver, as Delavan's and O'Meara's blue and white came to a stop halfway down the block. There were no parking spaces, and the driver made no effort to find one. He simply double-parked and let the clog of traffic behind him inch its laborious way through the loophole remaining, like a trickle of blood trying to serve a heart hopelessly clogged with cholesterol. Weaver checked the numbers on the side by the right front headlight, 744. Yes, that was the number they'd gotten from dispatch, all right. The flashers were on, and everything looked kosher, until the door opened and the driver stepped out. He was wearing a blue suit, all right, but not the kind that came with gold buttons and a silver badge. His shoes weren't police issue either, unless Staunton and Weaver had missed a memo notifying officers that duty footwear would henceforth come from Gucci. That didn't seem likely. What seemed likely was that this was the creep who had hijacked the cops uptown. He got out, oblivious to the honkings and cries of protest from the drivers trying to get by him.
"God damn," Andy Staunton breathed.
"Approach with extreme caution," the dispatcher had said. "This man is armed and extremely dangerous." Dispatchers usually sounded like the most bored human beings on Earth, for all Andy Staunton knew they were, and so the almost awed emphasis this one put on the word extremely had stuck to his consciousness like a burr. He drew his weapon for the first time in his 4 years on the force and glanced at Weaver. Weaver had also drawn. The two of them were standing outside a deli about 30 feet from the IRT stairway. They had known each other long enough to be attuned to each other in a way only cops and professional soldiers can be. Without a word between them, they stepped back into the doorway of the delicatessen, weapons pointing upward. "Subway?" Weaver asked.
"Yeah."
Andy took one quick glance at the entrance. Rush hour was in high gear now, and the subway stairs were clogged with people heading for their trains.
"We've got to take him right now, before he can get close to the crowd."
"Let's do it." They stepped out of the doorway in perfect tandem, gunslingers Roland would have recognized at once as adversaries much more dangerous than the first two. They were younger, for one thing, and although he didn't know it, some unknown dispatcher had labeled him extremely dangerous, and to Andy Staunton and Norris Weaver, that made him the equivalent of a rogue tiger.
"If he doesn't stop the second I tell him to, he's dead," Andy thought.
"Hold it!" he screamed, dropping into a crouch with his gun held out before him in both hands. Beside him, Weaver had done the same. "Police! Get your hands on your head!" That was as far as he got before the guy ran for the IRT stairway. He moved with a sudden speed that was uncanny. Nevertheless, Andy Staunton was wired, all his dials turned up to the max. He swiveled on his heels, feeling a cloak of emotionless coldness drop over him. Roland would have known this, too. He had felt it many times in similar situations. Andy led the running figure slightly, then squeezed the trigger of his .38. He saw the man in the blue suit spin around, trying to keep his feet. Then he fell to the pavement, as commuters, who only seconds ago had been concentrating on nothing but surviving another trip home on the subway, screamed and scattered like quail. They had discovered there was more to survive than the uptown train this afternoon.
"Holy fuck, partner!" Norris Wheaton breathed. "You blew him away!"
"I know," Andy said. His voice didn't falter. The gunslinger would have admired it. "Let's go see who he was." 11.
"I'm dead!" Jack Mort was screaming. "I'm dead! You've got me killed! I'm dead! I'm..."
"No," the gunslinger responded. Through slitted eyes, he saw the cops approaching, guns still out. Younger and faster than the ones who had been parked near the gun shop. Faster. And at least one of them was a hell of a shot. Mort, and Roland along with him, should have been dead, dying, or seriously wounded. Andy Staunton had shot to kill, and his bullet had drilled through the left lapel of Mort's suit coat. It had likewise punched through the pocket of Mort's Aero shirt. But that was as far as it went. The life of both men, the one inside and the one outside, were saved by Mort's lighter. Mort didn't smoke, but his boss, whose job Mort had confidently expected to have himself by this time next year, did. Accordingly, Mort had bought a $200 silver lighter at Dunhill's. He did not light every cigarette Mr. Framingham stuck in his gob when the two of them were together. That would have made him look too much like an ass-kisser. Just once in a while, and usually when someone even higher up was present, someone who could appreciate A. Jack Mort's quiet courtesy and B. Jack Mort's good taste. Doobies covered all the bases. This time, covering the bases saved his life and Roland's. Staunton's bullet smashed the silver lighter instead of Mort's heart, which was generic. Mort's passion for brand names, good brand names, stopped mercifully at the skin. He was hurt, just the same, of course. When you were hit by a heavy-caliber slug, there was no such thing as a free ride. The lighter was driven against his chest hard enough to create a hollow. It flattened and then smashed apart, digging shallow grooves in Mort's skin. One sliver of shrapnel sliced Mort's left nipple almost in two. The hot slug also ignited the lighter's fluid-soaked batting. Nevertheless, the gunslinger lay still as they approached. The one who had not shot him was telling people to stay back. Just stay back, goddammit.
I'm on fire! Mort shrieked. I'm on fire! Put it out! Put it out! Put it out!
The gunslinger lay still, listening to the grit of the gunslinger's shoes on the pavement, ignoring Mort's shrieks, trying to ignore the coal suddenly glowing against his chest and the smell of frying flesh. A foot slid beneath his ribcage, and when it lifted, the gunslinger allowed himself to roll bonelessly onto his back. Jack Mort's eyes were open. His face was slack. In spite of the shattered, burning remains of the lighter, there was no sign of the man screaming inside.
"God," someone muttered, "did you shoot him with a tracer, man?"
Smoke was rising from the hole in the lapel of Mort's coat in a neat little stream. It was escaping around the edge of the lapel in more untidy blotches. The cops could smell burning flesh as the wadding in the smashed lighter, soaked with Ronson lighter fluid, really began to blaze. Andy Staunton, who had performed faultlessly thus far, now made his only mistake, one for which court would have sent him home with a fat ear, in spite of his earlier admirable performance, telling him one mistake was all it took to get a man killed most of the time. Staunton had been able to shoot the guy, a thing no cop really knows if he can do until he's faced with a situation where he must find out. But the idea that his bullet had somehow set the guy on fire filled him with unreasoning horror. So he bent forward to put it out without thinking, and the gunslinger's feet smashed into his belly before he had time to do more than register the blaze of awareness in eyes he would have sworn were dead. Staunton went flailing back into his partner. His pistol flew from his hand. Wheaton held on to his own, but by the time he had gotten clear of Staunton, he heard a shot, and his gun was magically gone. The hand it had been in felt numb, as if it had been struck with a very large hammer. The guy in the blue suit got up, looked at them for a moment, and said, "You're good. Better than the others. So let me advise you. Don't follow. This is almost over. I don't want to have to kill you." Then he whirled and ran for the subway stairs. 12. The stairs were choked with people who had reversed their downward course when the yelling and shooting started, obsessed with that morbid and somehow unique New Yorker's curiosity to see how bad, how many, how much blood spilled on the dirty concrete. Yet somehow they still found a way to shrink back from the man in the blue suit who came plunging down the stairs. It wasn't much wonder. He was holding a gun, and another was strapped around his waist. Also, he appeared to be on fire. 13. Roland ignored Mort's increasing shrieks of pain as his shirt, undershirt, and jacket began to burn more briskly, as the silver of the lighter began to melt and run down his midsection to his belly in burning tracks. He could smell dirty, moving air, could hear the roar of an oncoming train. This was almost the time. The moment had almost come around. The moment when he would draw the three, or lose it all. For the second time, he seemed to feel worlds tremble and reel about his head. He reached the platform level and tossed the .38 aside. He unbuckled Jack Mort's pants and pushed them casually down, revealing a pair of white underdrawers like a whore's panties. He had no time to reflect on this oddity. If he did not move fast, he could stop worrying about burning alive. The bullets he had purchased would get hot enough to go off, and this body would simply explode. The gunslinger stuffed the boxes of bullets into the underdrawers, took out the bottle of Keflex, and did the same with it. Now the underdrawers bulged grotesquely. He stripped off the flaming suit jacket, but made no effort to take off the flaming shirt. He could hear the train roaring toward the platform, could see its light. He had no way of knowing it was a train which kept the same route as the one which had run over Odetta. But all the same, he did know. In matters of the tower, fate became a thing as merciful as the lighter which had saved his life, and as painful as the fire the miracle had ignited. Like the wheels of the oncoming train, it followed a course both logical and crushingly brutal, a course against which only steel and sweetness could stand. He hoiked up Mort's pants and began to run again, barely aware of the people scattering out of his way. As more air fed the fire, first his shirt collar and then his hair began to burn.
The heavy boxes in Mort's underdrawers slammed against his balls again and again, mashing them. Excruciating pain rose into his gut. He jumped the turnstile, a man who was becoming a meteor.
"Put me out!"
Mort screamed.
"Put me out before I burn up!"
"You ought to burn," the gunslinger thought grimly. "What's going to happen to you is more merciful than you deserve."
"What do you mean? What do you mean?"
The gunslinger didn't answer. In fact, turned him off entirely as he pelted toward the edge of the platform. He felt one of the boxes of shells trying to slip out of Mort's ridiculous panties and held it with one hand. He sent out every bit of his mental force toward the lady. He had no idea if such a telepathic command could be heard, or if the hearer could be compelled to obey. But he sent it just the same, a swift, sharp arrow of thought. The door. Look through the door. Now. Now. Train thunder filled the world. A woman screamed,
"Oh my God, he's going to jump!"
A hand slapped at his shoulder, trying to pull him back. Then Roland pushed the body of Jack Mort past the yellow warning line and dove over the edge of the platform. He fell into the path of the oncoming train, with his hands cupping his crotch, holding the luggage he would bring back. If that was, he was fast enough to get out of Mort at just the right instant. As he fell, he called her, them, again. "Odetta Holmes, Detta Walker, look now!" As he called, as the train bore down upon him, its wheels turning with merciless silver speed, the gunslinger finally turned his head and looked back through the door, and directly into her face. Faces! Both of them! I see both of them at the same time!
No!
Mort shrieked, and in the last split second before the train ran him down, cutting him in two, not above the knees but at the waist, Roland lunged at the door and through it. Jack Mort died alone. The boxes of ammunition and the bottle of pills appeared beside Roland's physical body. His hands clenched spasmodically at them, then relaxed. The gunslinger forced himself up, aware that he was wearing his sick, throbbing body again, aware that Eddie Dean was screaming, aware that Odetta was shrieking in two voices. He looked, only for a moment, and saw exactly what he had heard. Not one woman, but two. Both were legless, both dark-skinned, both women of great beauty. Nonetheless, one of them was a hag, her interior ugliness not hidden by her outer beauty, but enhanced by it. Roland stared at these twins, who were not really twins at all, but negative and positive images of the same woman. He stared with a feverish, hypnotic intensity. Then Eddie screamed again, and the gunslinger saw the lobstrosities tumbling out of the waves and strutting toward the place where Detta had left him, trussed and helpless. The sun was down. Darkness had come. 14. Detta saw herself in the doorway, saw herself through her eyes, saw herself through the gunslinger's eyes, and her sense of dislocation was as sudden as Eddie's, but much more violent. She was here. She was there in the gunslinger's eyes. She heard the oncoming train.
"Oh, Detta!"
she screamed, suddenly understanding everything, what she was and when it had happened.
"Detta!"
she screamed, suddenly understanding everything, what she was and who had done it. A brief sensation of being turned inside out, and then a much more agonizing one. She was being torn apart. 15. Roland shambled down the short slope to the place where Eddie lay. He moved like a man who has lost his bones. One of the lobster things clawed at Eddie's face. Eddie screamed. The gunslinger booted it away. He bent rustily and grabbed Eddie's arms. He began to drag him backwards, but it was too late. His strength was too little. They were going to get Eddie. Hell, both of them. Eddie screamed again as one of the lobstrosities asked him, "Did it, chick?" and then tore a swatch of his pants and a chunk of meat to go along with it. Eddie tried another scream, but nothing came out but a choked gargle. He was strangling and dead as knots. The things were all around them, closing in, claws clicking eagerly. The gunslinger threw the last of his strength into a final yank and tumbled backwards.
He heard them coming, them with their hellish questions and clicking claws. Maybe it wasn't so bad, he thought. He had staked everything, and that was all he had lost. The thunder of his own guns filled him with stupid wonder. 16. The two women lay face to face, bodies raised like snakes about to strike, fingers with identical prints locked around throats marked with identical lines. The woman was trying to kill her, but the woman was not real, no more than the girl had been real. She was a dream created by a fallen brick. But now the dream was real. The dream was clawing her throat and trying to kill her, as the gunslinger tried to save his friend. The dream made real was screeching obscenities and raining hot spittle into her face.
I took the blue plate because that woman landed me in the hospital. And besides, I didn't get no for special plate. And I bust it because it needed busting. And when I saw a white boy I could bust, why, I bust him too. I hurt the white boys because they needed hurting. I stole from the stores that only sell things that are for special to white folks, while the brothers and sisters go hungry in Harlem and the rats eat their babies. I'm the one, you bitch. I'm the one. I.
Kill her, Odetta thought, and knew she could not. She could no more kill the hag and survive than the hag could kill her and walk away. They could choke each other to death while Eddie and the Roland, really bad man, one who had called them, were eaten alive down there by the edge of the water. That would finish all of them. Or she could love, hate, let go. Odetta let go of Detta's throat, ignored the fierce hands throttling her, crushing her windpipe. Instead of using her own hands to choke, she used them to embrace the other.
"No, you bitch!"
Detta screamed. But that scream was infinitely complex, both hateful and grateful.
"No, you leave me alone. You just leave me."
Odetta had no voice with which to reply. As Roland kicked the first attacking lobstrosity away, and as the second moved in to lunch on a chunk of Eddie's arm, she could only whisper in the witch woman's ear, "I love you." For a moment the hands tightened into a killing noose and then loosened. Were gone. She was being turned inside out again. And then, suddenly, blessedly, she was whole. For the first time since a man named Jack Mort had dropped a brick on the head of a child who was only there to be hit because a white taxi driver had taken one look and driven away, and had not her father, in his pride, refused to try again for fear of a second refusal, she was whole. She was Odetta Holmes, but the other... "Hurry up, bitch!" Detta yelled. But it was still her own voice. She and Detta had merged. She had been one, she had been two. Now the gunslinger had drawn a third from her. "Hurry up, or they're going to be dinner." She looked at the shells. There was no time to use them. By the time she had his guns reloaded, it would be over. She could only hope. "But is there anything else?" she asked herself, and drew. And suddenly her brown hands were full of thunder. 17. Eddie saw one of the lobstrosities loom over his face, its rugose eyes dead, yet hideously sparkling with hideous life. Its claws descended toward his face.
"Dada!"
it began, and then it was smashed backward in chunks and splatters. Roland saw one skitter toward his flailing left hand and thought, "There goes the other hand," and then the lobstrosity was a splatter of shell and green guts flying into the dark air. He twisted around and saw a woman whose beauty was heart-stopping, whose fury was heart-freezing.
"Come on, muffas," she screamed. "You just come on. You just come for 'em. I'm gonna blow your eyes right back through your fucking assholes."
She blasted a third one that was crawling rapidly between Eddie's spraddled legs, meaning to eat on him and neuter him at the same time. It flew like a tiddlywink. Roland had suspected they had some rudimentary intelligence. Now he saw the proof. The others were retreating. The hammer of one revolver fell on a dud, and then she blew one of the retreating monsters into gobbets. The others ran back toward the water even faster. It seemed they had lost their appetite. Meanwhile, Eddie was strangling. Roland fumbled at the rope, digging a deep furrow into his neck. He could see Eddie's face melting slowly from purple to black. Eddie's strugglings were weakening. Then his hands were pushed away by stronger ones. "I'll take care of it,"
There was a knife in her hand. His knife. Take care of what? He thought as his consciousness faded. What is it you'll take care of now that we're both at your mercy?
Who are you?
He husked, as darkness deeper than night began to take him down. I am three women, he heard her say, and it was as if she were speaking to him from the top of a deep well into which he was falling. I who was, I who had no right to be but was, I am the woman who you have saved. I thank you, gunslinger. She kissed him. He knew that, but for a long time after, Roland knew only darkness.